C1SP. Number 3B.
So here we get first the what you will deal in the first part, namely an analysis of the question, what are identities of being and what are not identities of being, showing that only science can show us what are the identities of being, and that spiritualism, that which relies on the physical senses, cannot analyze the identities of being. Now, if something is an enigma or a mystery, it doesn't remain an enigma or a mystery. Every enigma can be solved. Any mystery can be solved. But it needs science to solve it. And so Mrs. Eddy speaks in various ways in this chapter how science dispels mystery and explains extraordinary phenomena. But science never removes phenomena from the domain of reason into the realm of mysticism. You see, things which are a mystery and an enigma on the plane of spiritualism, on the plane of duality, on the plane where we believe in material and mental identities of being, on that plane everything seems to be a mystery because it is based on a basis which is not science and therefore not reasonable. But this chapter will help us, will be that savior which comes to us and says, if we base ourselves not on spiritualism or the belief of duality, but if we base ourselves on the basis of a science, of pure deduction from spirit, then we find a reason and an explanation not only for what is real, but we find also an explanation for what is unreal. We solve the enigma of mortal existence. We will solve that big enigma of existence in which we live. Our mortal universe, our material universe, and our spirit, our mental universe, will solve that mystery. And in solving that mystery, naturally, we free ourselves from the impacts of that mystery. We'll free ourselves from spirits. From spirits. In the spirits taken in its wider general sense of believing in material, corporeal identities of being. Or she says that we can solve the mysteries of being through an apprehension of the divine principle, she says in this chapter. You see, so if we start in, we don't say, well, it is a mystery and it remains a mystery. It is an enigma and it remains an enigma. No. It is, the chapter is Christian science versus spiritualism. It is science versus enigma and mystery. Then she goes on and says, I think here she indicates the second part of the chapter, but the revelations of Christian science unlock the treasures of truth. Whatever is false or sinful can never enter the atmosphere of spirit. Again, we have the overtone of spirit, which shows that in the atmosphere of spirit, nothing can enter which is wrong. Therefore, if we are consistent in our deduction from the one spirit on the basis of science, that can unlock. Unlock. You see, now we come to the uncovering. Can unlock what the treasures of truth. And the second part will be all about this mind reading, of mortal mind reading and divine mind reading, unlocking the treasures of truth, hidden in secret secrecy. And then it's there where she asks for the first time, after 88 pages in the textbook, where for the first time she asks, what are veritable truths, veritable ideas, and what are illusions? Up to now she never asked what are ideas. She hardly ever mentioned the term idea. She didn't mention the term idea in the chapter on prayer, not once. She didn't mention the term idea in the chapter on marriage, not once. She only mentioned it occasionally in the chapter on atonement and Eucharist, but there more in the sense of the idea of God, that we must have the true idea of God. But now when it comes to the scientific analysis and uncovering of what really is, she asks now, what are ideas and what are illusions? Then, I think she goes on to the third part, where she says in this introductory paragraph, there is but one spirit, man. Now she takes in the term man. Man is never God, but spiritual man, made in God's likeness, reflects God. In this scientific reflection, the ego and the Father are inseparable. Now you come to the inseparability of God and man, or of God and his spiritual universe. And so that the supposition, you see now, that's not science to have a supposition. The supposition that corporeal beings are spirits, or that there are good and evil spirits, is a mistake. Now she wipes it away. We come now to the annihilation of the belief in spiritualism, showing that all that is not a reflection of the one spirit, and therefore all that which is not inseparable from God's spirit is a mistake, and therefore is a supposition, and is called a mistake, therefore false, untrue, and so we get the sense of annihilation. In that third part, we will find over and over that unity of the ego and the Father, that inseparability of God and man, of God and his spiritual universe. And that naturally is the death blow to spiritualism, because spiritualism always would transfer man from the spiritual sense of existence to the material sense of existence. Spiritualism always believes in a fallen man, in a fallen angel, in Lucifer. You call it Lucifer?
Yeah.
Lucifer. And that man can fall. That the identities of being, which are spiritual, could fall to a material sense of existence. But if we see that in the oneness and infiniteness of reality, there is no place where to go outside of this infinite spirit, that there is no nature outside of this infinite to be turned to, then we begin to see the complete nothingness of the belief of spiritualism. Well, that's the introductory paragraph of this chapter, which will show us how, through three parts, and actually as we go on and go through those three parts and we turn then afterwards back to this introductory paragraph, it will become clearer and more tangible and more definite, and it will yield more meaning to us. So, let's turn now to the first part. To the first part, and reading through this first part and comparing the tone pervading the first part, comparing that tone, say, with the first three chapters, one can't help feeling that there is a quite different tone or atmosphere or tendency governing that first part. Namely, one gets at once a feeling that here now she uses the scientific method of analysis. That now she bases herself on scientific logic. That it is no more showing so much a rule of life as in the first three chapters, but that now she analyzes and says what is really behind the main themes of the first three chapters. What is reality? And so, reading those pages over and over, you get so many indications that now she presents this word as science. We get all those terms of science and scientific basis, of divine logic, of scientific phenomena, of the science of man, the science of spirit, what is scientifically impossible, and so on. Just feel that thing, that now we have to stand on the basis, on the reasoning of what is scientific and what is unscientific. That now that which governs, which must govern our reason, that which must govern now our lives, our attitude, is science versus unscientific logic. Scientific logic versus unscientific reasoning. See, to show the difference, if we turn back to the chapter on marriage, what were the subjects there? The subject was there appealing to wonderful qualities which each one of us has, like lawfulness, pure affection, selflessness, and ascendancy of good, and so on. You see, it was appealing to qualities. Here, the chapter appeals to science, to scientific reasoning in us, to the willingness to reason and have a logic which is scientific, and therefore to take the stand of that which is scientific and logic, though it is testifying contrary to the material senses. It's all a question of science versus senses. The senses, as she has said in that introductory paragraph, can never solve the mysteries of being, can never solve the enigma of mortal existence, because the testimony of the corporeal senses cannot inform us what is real and what is not real. Therefore, here we touch scientific reasoning. See, where we look away and from all that what mortal mind tells us, where we look away from all that what the senses call real and what the senses testify to us. That we look away from those three false pillars of nature, namely mortal mind, matter, and sense testimony, and look away and let us be informed and instructed by pure scientific logic. Logic always deduced from one great premises, namely that there is only one infinite spirit, and never deviate from that. So, whereas, for instance, marriage appealed to those finer human qualities in us, like law-abidingness, lawfulness, pure affection, selflessness, and so on, appeals to that in us, this chapter appeals to quite a different strata of our consciousness. Namely, it appeals to that in us which constitutes man, namely his faculty of thinking scientifically, logically, and not be influenced by sense testimony. So just have a look, if that is not true, how often she uses terms which depict the scientific standpoint, and then very many, about 30 or 40, of the unscientific standpoint, where she shows that we can't always rely on supposition and presupposition and of mistaken assumption and of false admissions and of beliefs and falsities and I don't know what, you see. And also, This chapter, this first part, as I have said, appeals to our analytical sense, to the science sense, which in its one form, science has always three forms, it analyzes. Through this analysis, he can depict what it uncovers by depicting what is real and what is unreal, and then through that uncovering of what is real and unreal, it has the means how to get rid of the unreal and to dispose of that which is unreal and to nurture and culture that which is real. That's the third, the annihilation, or positively seeing the development of the true. Here, when we read the text here, we just can't feel that there is another music. Just as I think Bach is very different from Strauss, and Chopin is very different from Tchaikovsky, I think. I don't know anything about music, but I think so much I know. Just as it's just different, it's just not the same, you see. So these chapters are different, but they are all necessary. They all constitute the whole matrix of immortality, and therefore those 16 chapters constitute man, our being. But we must see that if we turn to another chapter, that another strain, perhaps of our whole being, is touched, and that we listen to that strain. Here, again, we get that sense of analysis. The whole text is always something like this, which says, this is and this is not. This is always, this is never. See, you always have a clear-cut analysis that something is, well, then the other can't be. That if something is, then the opposite can't be. That if that one thing is real, then the opposite is unreal. If something is always, then the opposite can never be. See, it makes no compromise and concession, you see. The moment we touch science, those concessions which we have made in the first chapter, in the second chapter, in the third chapter, which in the third chapter were even proposed to be done to a certain measure, the concession to matter for the advancement of spiritual good where it is necessary. Here, when it comes to science, there is nothing like that. No more concession, no more compromise. It's a clear-cut analysis. Therefore, you get all those terms in it. Something is, something is not. Something is ever, something is never. It is either this or that. It is nothing is true if the other one is true. It is neither nor and all these things. You may think, well, that's not important. For me, it's very important. I don't know why, because it's such a pure thing that comes in, such a pure strain that comes into these pages, and which show us where we are, where we stand, and what our standpoint must be if we really want to break through that wall of matter. And those walls of Jericho must fall. They must fall. If our trumpets are really blowing seven times, those walls must fall. If we see spirit in its purity, that is, in its sevenfoldness, then the walls of matter must fall. They can't stand anymore because they have no more hold in our consciousness. And that's the only place where they can fall and must fall. Now I have to stop.